Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is the former director of the Globe Theatre. He's also an award-winning author with three books to his credit. He's organised a theatre tour of the entire world, now runs a film company and is about to launch a session of Oscar Wilde plays in the West End. Dominic Drumgoole, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Lovely to be here, thank you.
Well, thank you for coming in, because you are one of the best known directors working in British theatre today, so it's a huge honour for us to have you here.
Well, I don't know about that, but it's very kind of you to say so.
Your father was also a theatre director and your mother had been an actress, so presumably you grew up in an artistic atmosphere. And I wonder if you could take us back to the farm in Somerset where you spent your childhood.
Yeah, we grew up on a farm in the sort of triangle between Wells, Glastonbury and Cheddar, and in fact an enormously long way away from theatre and television and film. I think my father put my mother and my brother and my sister and me on the farm for a complex collection of reasons. At some moments they said it was because of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which I never sure I completely bought, but we were there. So really it was combine harvesters and summer sunshine and milking cows and a very, very, very rural scene. I mean, Somerset then was sort of closer to the 19th century than it was to the 21st. But a lovely place to grow up. And then every weekend or every other weekend, my father would arrive with astonishing guests and people from London or from Bristol, which is where he did most of his work, who would sort of razzle and dazzle and glamorise the place for a bit, and then they'd disappear off and it would be back to playing football for Blackford Villa under 12s and milking the cows.
And presumably those visitors and indeed your parents fostered this love of theatre within you.
Yeah, it was always there. I mean, I played at being a farmer for a while and enjoyed milking the cows and enjoyed hanging around on the farm, but that was always a bit unreal. I was always going to work in the theatre in the same way as the son of a lawyer wants to be a lawyer, or the son of a plumber, his first instinct is to be a plumber. So it just felt like sort of following on a family tradition.
Mm. And when you were 16, of course, you formed your own theatre company.
Yeah, daft. The most embarrassing and appalling and shameful name. It was called Cheap Street Theatre Company, which was our sort of desperate attempt to look more urban and real and authentic than we in fact were. But although our company was formed in a small town called Street in Somerset. Yes, we did some shows locally, some Edward Bond plays, some Barry Keefe plays, David Halliwell plays, and then we toured them to the Edinburgh Festival and a little bit around the UK as well.
Mm, that Edinburgh Festival experience seems like a real rite of passage for anybody who wants to work in the theatre.
Oh, it's glorious. It's glorious. My kids are doing it now and you envy them that innocence and that excitement and that weird thrill of going up there, engaging in artistic endeavour, doing it for the hell of it, doing it for an audience of two or three or less, being so overexcited by being in the presence of your own generation who are all wanting to do the same thing, falling in love just about on the hour, every hour, you know, with somebody with sad eyes across a canteen, and being thrilled by seeing the work of other people. It's delicious experience. I did three intense years of it back then and have never really been back, because I sort of tend not to go back places.
Mm. After that, of course, you went up to Cambridge. Did you continue with theatre there?
Yes, I did. I think I was there at a very dowdy moment. Cambridge was a very beaten up town at that moment. It was before all of the money and all the high tech industry came in. It didn't sort of have any of the propulsion and self-confidence and entitlement that it has now. That's rubbish. I mean, it's always had entitlement, but it wasn't as sort of aggressive as it is now. So Cambridge was a lot of theatre, but largely it was taking speed and hanging out in betting shops and drinking too much and wondering when exciting Brideshead things were going to start happening, because they seemed to be an awfully long way away.
Did they ever happen?
No, nothing remotely like that. I mean, it was all quite sort of entertainingly grubby and small time. And I mean, I remember running out of my grant in the happy, lovely days of grant and having no money at all to sort of subsidise my own passage. So what we used to do is we used to have Heffers, which was a local bookshop, bizarrely gave us a credit card, a Heffers credit card that you could buy books on. So we used to buy books, very expensive art books, first thing in the morning, go round the corner to a second-hand bookshop, sell them immediately for £20 or £25 to buy speed and to buy alcohol and get through a day on that, and then the next morning go round and buy a whole load more fresh new art books. So I ran up the most astonishing heifer's bill. And unlike other bills, which I've sort of run away from over the years, the heifer's one was the most scary and chasing itself down. And one day I was in my room and these two men with sort of bodies too big for their suits and dark glasses banged on the door and said, "Hello, we're from heifers." Oh, Jesus. The bookshops are really taking this sort of thing seriously. And so I had to pay up. But that's not really very Brideshead, is it? I mean, as an anecdote, that's about as far from as evil in war as you can get.
You then went on to work at the Bush Theatre. So that was really your breakthrough into professional theatre, wasn't it?
That was the biggest break and the biggest privilege of all my life, yeah. I got in as assistant director at the Bush by a great happenstance. I learned to sort of trade there and I learned to craft. I was able to get rid of all sorts of theorising and ideologies and mad patterned ideas of what theatre should be, and I just realised that it was a solid, hard-working craft and that it's about putting things together and putting them together as well as you can. And the Bush taught me that, and then by an astonishing piece of luck and by the great generosity of some very lovely people, I was given the job of artistic director at what at the time was a very young age, about 26. And then at the Bush was able to work with just an unbelievable collection of writers who were wanting to have their plays on stage at that moment, and a sort of energy and a wildness and a variety. This was about 1990. That it was just thrilling to sort of sit on the horse and ride it.
Mm, and these were all mostly new plays, of course.
All new plays, yeah. No, we did about 65 new world premieres over 6 years. An incredible variety of writers. And all writing very boldly and wildly and creatively. It was an incredibly lucky moment to be in that job within a London and a UK culture that was writing very, very imaginatively.
And you took that work on new plays over to the Old Vic to work with Peter Hall.
Yep, no, new plays have always been at the centre of my idea of what theatre should be, and I went on and worked for a year at Peter Hall with a season of new work alongside his company, and then carried that on through the Oxford Stage Company when I was there, and then on through the Globe.
So it was during that time, though, that you came to write your first book in 2000, I think, The Full Room, an A to Z of Contemporary Playwriting.
Yes. Yeah, I never thought I'd write. Writing's always been a surprise to me. I wrote an obituary for a great friend who is a playwright who'd written a play that we were working on, and he died just before we went into rehearsal. So for the programme of an Old Vic show, I wrote an obituary for him, and it was picked up by The Independent. And it was one of those sort of surprises when I wrote it and it felt happy and comfortable writing it, and then a surprise when the paper picked it up and I saw it in print, and you just sort of go, oh. And then I wrote a couple of introductions for other books of plays and so on, and I suddenly thought, oh, I can just about get away with this. So I wrote a collection of about 112 essays, really, really, really short, some of them one sentence long, some of them about six words long, some of them about three or four pages long, about playwrights. And I wrote with an enormous cavalier freedom, possibly excessive freedom, and I wrote from the ground rather than from the top of the mountain, because a friend of mine said, oh, please don't, you know, pretend you're an authority and live on the top of a mountain, write from within yourself and from the middle of the industry. So it's certainly punchy, I'll say that for it. My great friend's just about a year ago was thrown out of a book group in Suffolk, and the person who was throwing her out searched for the right word to describe why the rest of the group felt she couldn't be in it any longer. And they said, we just feel you're a little punchy. And it was their way of saying that she was a bit on the opinionated side. And so my book was a bit opinionated and it got me into a fair amount of trouble.
With playwrights?
Yeah, actually, it's a hugely positive book. I mean, about 106 of the 112 essays are very positive and celebrating what was a golden moment for playwriting. But when at that moment I felt sort of punchy towards playwrights, I sort of let go a bit, and possibly a bit excessively. But I thought it was better to be honest to my own feelings than to sort of plaster them over with a condescending, polite superiority. So it still reads very fresh and it still reads very bold, and I won't disown any of it, but it was, I didn't want to hurt anyone, and I sort of regret if I had hurt anyone.
Well, you then went from brand new plays to the oldest plays in the world almost, and that's Shakespeare, because then you started at the Globe in 2005 when you took over from Mark Rylance.
Yeah, Shakespeare had always been a huge part of my life. My parents were both ardent Shakespeareans. My home had always been dominated by The Complete Works, which was a much more powerful book than The Bible or Das Kapital or any of the other big, heavy tomes that sort of dominate a family house. The Complete Works sort of sat in the middle of our home and emitted powerful waves, as it does in a lot of homes around the world, I think. So it had always been something I've been obsessed with. Then I've been asked to write a book about Shakespeare for Penguin, and about growing up with Shakespeare and about what it's like to grow up with Shakespeare. And so I'd been through that, and that had really sharpened my sense and appreciation of what a great gift to the world he is.
Let's just talk about that book. It's called Will and Me, How Shakespeare Took Over My Life.
Yeah, no, it's an account from cradle to the moment I'd reached at that point of what it is like to have Shakespeare as the most sort of powerful informing presence. Somebody that you learn from, somebody that you argue with, somebody that occasionally you walk away from in disgust, and then someone that you return to. And Shakespeare was that for me always. And so I sort of recounted what a life under his umbrella was like, and enjoyed writing it hugely. And then finished with the last third of a book is an account of a walk I did with a great friend of mine, where we walked from Stratford-on-Avon to the Globe over a week, which is heavy on the feet, but was very invigorating for the mind. And so I write about that walk as a sort of travelogue of two eccentric figures. My friend, who's taller and sort of loftier than me, as a sort of Don Quixote, and me as a short, fat, sweaty Sancho Panza. And we walked through Warwickshire and Oxfordshire and along the Thames into London. So, and I wrote that up as a sort of travelogue.
And of course, your next book kind of carries on that theme. Oh. So you're working at the Globe. You put on the fantastically successful Globe to Globe Festival.
Yeah, no, we had a great time at the Globe, and we were very expansionist and very free in our thinking and knew no boundaries or no limitations, really, which is the most exhilarating place to be in any artistic organisation. And so whatever we did or wanted to do, we carried through. We came up with an idea for the Olympic year, which was to do every play of Shakespeare's, each in a different language, each presented by a different company from abroad, the Globe to Globe Festival, as we called it. And this astonishing group of artists and theatre companies from all over the world came to us. Brilliant combinations of artists and play. South Sudan formed its own national theatre company to bring Cymbeline to us. Three Balkan countries came together to do the Henry VI plays.
Which, and they'd never collaborated before, had they?
They'd never collaborated before, and it started a process of collaboration between those countries and others in the Balkan area, which has flourished ever since. We had a Comedy of Errors from Afghanistan that was rehearsed in British Council compound there until the compound was stormed by insurgents and they had to leave, and they finished rehearsing in India, and then they brought it to us. Incredibly moving, powerful, simple, grave version of the play. A Maori company came and did Troilus and Cressida and gloriously celebrated the power of their own language and their own language to tell that play, but also it was a great moment of arrival for them as a company, because a lot of them have been very powerful activists for the Maori language within the New Zealand education system and within New Zealand culture. And so to have the ability to do that play in Maori language on the Globe stage was huge. And many other stories like that. A wonderful British Sign Language performance of Love Sabre's Lost which was a sort of, as someone said, from that community, was a sort of real moment of arrival for that community, being able to present a play to 1,500 British Sign Language people all over the auditorium. We had an Israeli company who came and did The Merchant of Venice, which meant we had to have airport security, and we had 100 police and 60 security people and two demonstrations going on outside, one anti-Israeli, one pro-Israeli. And we had a Palestinian company come and do a brilliant definitive production of Richard II. So we were really able to just show quite how broad and expansive Shakespeare is, and quite how far he reaches into the world, and quite how many boundaries, ideological, geographical, religious, he can cross, and how people can still accept him into their lives from an immensely varied number of different cultures. So we did that. It was glory. It was just absolute thrill to do. And then after it, later that year, we were feeling a little bit listless, as you do after you've done something that sort of feels like it's a signature event. And we were drunk, for want of a better word, and excited. And we were in a bar, and we were planning and that next great venture, which was building a small theatre and how we were going to program a small theatre. And the idea popped up into our heads, why don't we take Hamlet to every country in the world? And so we resolved to take Hamlet to every country in the world.
And you did. And your book, Hamlet Globe to Globe, Taking Shakespeare to Every Country in the World, has come out hugely successful, wonderfully written book, and highly entertaining, although it sounds quite fraught sometimes, the journey.
It was very harum-scarum, and it was very high risk, and we had some astonishing people steering it and managing it and actually concealing from me, who sort of quite likes to wander around being blithe and bonny and Pollyanna-ish most of the time, quite how harum-scarum it was. But there were moments when we'd fly into a country in the morning and be pretty unsure of where we were playing in the evening, and they'd whisk together a venue at the very, very last moment, which would almost astonishingly fill up. But there were other venues that we went to that were incredibly well planned and very prestigious and very grand. And all across the world, we were playing to largely free audiences. Certainly in South America and in Africa, we were playing to free audiences. So these theatres would pack out with people very, very hungry for this play. And the collision between the world and the play and what each spoke about the other became rather illuminating.
Why choose Hamlet?
Hamlet because it's protean and it shows a different face in each different direction. We knew that we'd be going to countries in a collection of different moments, some needing inspiration, some needing a challenge, some needing a provocation, some needing consoling. And we knew that Hamlet could do a variety of different jobs because it's beautiful. It's just an astonishingly beautiful artifact in itself. And because primarily it's mysterious and it's oblique. And if you took a play around that the company could work out and could understand and could get into every nook and cranny of and every corner of, you, the company, would be dead on your feet very quickly, because it's very hard to do a play with genuine enthusiasm, genuine freshness, genuine excitement if you've solved it. If it's still a mystery to you, if it's still asking you questions, then it leaves you permanently running after it. And Hamlet does that beautifully.
The book is a wonderful account of all the different places you went, the different venues from makeshift stands to grand opera houses, the different receptions you got from people, and places like performing in refugee camps, not being able to perform in North Korea, and all the trouble you got into for suggesting that you should go to a regime like that. It's done incredibly well. How have you found the response?
Hey, it's been, on a personal level, fantastic. People have said lovely and wonderful things. Very generous writing about it, especially in America.
Because, of course, you performed it for Obama, didn't you?
We performed it for Obama, yeah, we did. He came and we gave him a little sneak preview of it in, or was it not preview, sort of end of run excerpt on the weekend when we finished at the Globe. And it's done well here. I mean, I think, there's occasionally you... What we ran into when we did our Globe to Globe Festival, what we ran into with this tour, what you still run into is this awful prissy authoritarianism of the left, where people tell you off for going places, and this sort of plain nastiness of the right, where they don't like the idea of any artistic endeavour crossing a boundary and creating further dialogue between nations. So occasionally you do, you know, bump your head on that, but that's all part of the fun of the fair.
Well, this book was, I suppose, the crowning achievement of your time at the Globe. It was something that, which you could put out there when you left. Why did you leave after 10 years?
Oh, you've got to go. You've got to go. After a while, you've got to go. 10 years was as long as anyone should be there, really. Mark was there for 10 years. I gave it 10 years. You know, there's a good, honest etiquette within British theatre culture that you've got to go after 10 years. And it's a right thing to do, because you shouldn't be in control of public taste for that long. You should open the door to other people. And it was great that someone else came in who was very different, had a very different take and very different taste, and reinvented the place. And then, you know, in the future, other people will reinvent it.
Tell me what you're doing now, then.
Now, I've got a film company, made a film last summer called Making Noise Quietly, which we're just putting out and about. We're making three more films across this summer, one called Undercliff we've made in Bradford, one we're making in Doncaster at the moment called Pond Life, another called Benjamin that we start making at the end of this week. It is astonishingly, backbreakingly busy at the moment, because essentially we're making, shooting three films across 3.5 months, which is a little bit bananas.
Full-length films.
Full-length features, yeah, fully equipped, fully ready to go, lovely stories, lovely scripts about human stuff and human matter, and a joy to do, but it's quite heavy going work-wise, but thrilling. And then the end of this year in September, I start going to rehearsals for an Oscar Wilde season, where we're taking the Vaudeville Theatre in the West End for a year to present a series of plays about Oscar Wilde, by Oscar Wilde, and also a series of sort of perspectives on Oscar Wilde, to sort of fully celebrate the Oscar across a whole year. So I'm going into rehearsals on A Woman of No Importance, which opens at the beginning of October, then Lady Windermere's, then Ideal Husband, then Importance of Being Earnest.
That's tremendously exciting.
Oh, it's thrilling, actually. He's extraordinary, and it's been great delving into Oscar world and realising quite how broad a landscape he covered in terms of his imagination and his thinking and his philosophy and his politics and his sense of fun, but how many people respond very fiercely and passionately to him, is that you can go from, you know, an amazing historian of queer London and queer culture and quite what an iconic figure he was within that, and you can go to a very left-wing politician who's obsessed with The Soul of Man Under Socialism that he wrote, which is a foundational text for many people's politics, including mine in many ways. And then you can go to very conservative people who think that Oscar Wilde is a brilliant wit and a great entertainer and a great comedian, all of which he was. So he's true for each community, and he's true for each person, and he has that capacity, like Shakespeare in a way, to be truly comprehensive as a figure.
And so what will you write next?
I've got no idea. I can't even write another book. I've got enough on. I don't know. Some polemic will upset everyone.
Well, in the interim, people can read Hamlet Globe to Globe. It's published by Canongate, and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to Wei Dongling. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.